You're listening to the World of Higher Education podcast, Season 2, Episode 27.
Hello, I'm Alex Usher, and this is the World of Higher Education podcast. In many ways, the biggest stories of the last 20 years in global higher education have been stories about technology, massive open online courses, also known as MOOCs, the rise and spectacular fall of private online higher education, the rise, in the United States at least, of major public sector online universities, and the growth and controversy of so-called online program management providers, or OPMs. And of course, there was the great global experiment in remote learning that was COVID. These stories haven't just been about technology. They have also been about some fundamentally different ways in which higher education has been managed and delivered. What's made them so jarring in a higher education context is not simply that they represent a new type of mixing of private and public sector entities. It's the astounding volatility of the markets in which these companies exist, the fact that the markets within which universities are operating evolve so quickly, and the volatility of universities' corporate partners' fortunes as they struggle with new technologies and business models. Today, my guest is Phil Hill, an EdTech consultant and lead at Phil Hill & Associates. Phil is by far my favorite commentator on all issues related to educational technology and higher education institutions. And today he joins us to talk about these last 20 years and how they've shaped the sector. We range pretty widely across a number of topics here, but the most interesting ones for me actually had to do with the historic role of MOOCs. We agreed that they were a failure, judged by the claims they made about their own impact at the time. But Phil argues, pretty persuasively, I think, that they might just possibly have been a key turning point in the history of the delivery of higher education. I'll let you judge Phil's argument for yourselves. Let's turn it over to him. So, Phil, I'd like to start this interview by taking us back about 20, 25 years to around the turn of the century in the early 2000s. And at the time, online education, in the popular imagination at least, was the domain of for-profits. So, you know, organizations like Capella or Strayer, and most famously or infamously, the University of Phoenix. Why was it that at that time, for-profit companies, for-profit universities had the field to themselves? And why did they ultimately fail?
I think the reason they had it to themselves mostly is there was a prestige issue, as online education was sort of viewed as, okay, we get the need to reach student populations, but if I'm in a traditional school, that's continuing ed, or it's somebody else that does it. It's the dirty business. Don't tarnish what we're doing. And the for-profits took a very different point of view. It's, no, our goal is to reach a different student group with different needs, and we'll redesign the organization and the structures to be able to reach them. So they basically just didn't hold themselves back like other organizations did. And you did have the Sloan Consortium, which enabled a lot of nonprofit schools to get an online ed, but they were sort of the exceptions to prove the rule. The University of Central Florida, Arizona State, a lot of the online leaders today really got their start back then, but most of the field was nonprofit. What they got wrong, and I've done some work deep inside some of the for-profits, and there were some bad actors. So first of all, there were a few schools that were just bad actors. But by and large, what I'd say is the for-profits were good on trying to figure out how to serve and support first generation students, working adults, different student populations, and putting their money into doing it. But they also fell into this trap of always setting their tuition to the max that the federal government would allow for financial aid. So it became a whole game of maximizing financial aid every single year. So I'd say that was the biggest problem. And then I think the runaway success of the University of Phoenix also led to some hubris of we can keep going forever. So I'd say those were the two failure points that happened to a lot of the for-profits.
And since the high point of for-profit online education in the United States, which I guess was around 2009, 2010, we've seen a wave of nonprofit institutions, some private, move in to dominate the space, to become really mega universities. So I'm thinking here specifically Western Governors, Southern New Hampshire. I think those are both in the six-figure now student numbers. And Arizona State University must be getting close to 100,000 students in the online space. What have those institutions done right that others have not?
take Southern New Hampshire. I think early on, a lot of the talk with the College for America was around competency-based education and some other approaches. But I think more important to what they did is it was almost like a Harvard case study, where they said, all right, if we're going to serve these students, how would we design the university? Very similar to what I said the for-profits did. And they just did an excellent job of redesigning the university for the online students. But to their benefit, they also emphasized low tuition and service and finding out how do you serve refugees. If you look at Western governors, theirs was based on competency-based education, which inevitably led to a lower-priced education and very much customized to the student. But keep in mind, they started a decade before that. So yeah, it was a long time before they started getting huge. Arizona State, what have they done? They've been willing to experiment. They try anything, but they're also willing to admit, hey, this isn't working. Let's shut down this initiative and go somewhere else. So I think all three of those were willing to bet big, but to recognize that a lot of the bet was long-term restructuring and investment in an organization that can meet those phases. And I would say all three really also emphasize more of the let's keep tuition under control. And that was core to their ethos for developing the online education. Arizona State University was a little bit more of an access. Why can't we be Berkeley, but without any restrictions on size? Let's take this quality and go throughout there. So I think those, for those big players, were the big secrets, if you will, on how they've succeeded so far.
So another major development, say, in the last 7 or 8 years was that some of those former for-profit giants were acquired by public institutions. So Ashford became part of the University of Arizona. Kaplan became part of Purdue. The University of Phoenix has been trying hard to sell itself to a couple of universities. I guess they tried at Arkansas, are currently trying to work out a purchase by the University of Idaho. What's going on? Like, why did this happen? What are the purported benefits to public institutions of acquiring these former private for-profit giants? How are these mergers turning out in practice?
You have to start out with Purdue Global. That's where Purdue University acquired Kaplan and turned that into Purdue Global. And Mitch Daniels was behind that, who is a very smart politician and financial. So if you'd say, why did they get started? It's a land-grant university. They believe their job is to go reach more students. And here was a chance to really jumpstart that effort and take advantage of the environment of for-profits who needed to get out of the space. And he wanted to serve the state of Indiana. So Purdue started it. Now, I've written about this, including some inside information that even today they've turned around the enrollment decline, but they're just now getting to where their financials are break even. So it's been a long-term investment for them. To be honest, beyond Purdue Global, a lot of what drives it is what I call Mitch Daniels envy. It's a bunch of presidents who say, hey, everybody's talking about Mitch. I want to be like him. And there's a legacy aspect to a lot of these. That doesn't mean these other schools don't believe they should try to serve other students, but a lot of it is prestige and looking to what Purdue did. Arizona is a disaster, what's happening down there. They bought the wrong online school and they completely deceived themselves on what it could do. So what's happening out there? Now, ironically, the University of Phoenix has turned itself around. It's got a better enrollment. They've cut way back on their programs to make it manageable. Their finances are solid. Ironically, they've turned themselves around, but it's no done deal that they're going to be purchased by Idaho, again, because of the process of buying them. How is it going? It's a lot of schools trying different methods, but in general, it's been unsatisfying results, and a lot of it, in my opinion, is based on too much of it was based on hubris as opposed to an honest accounting of what it's going to take to make them successful.
You just mentioned Purdue, though, as the successful or the relatively, you know, among these, the most successful one. What kind of extra reach does Kaplan give them? So they're outside of that part of Indiana that they normally serve. How broad is this, does Kaplan make them? Are they a national? Are they international, as the word global would suggest?
Now, it's not, yeah, it's mostly national, but I think more of their success is in Indiana. I think where they've done a good job, because just taking the same institution and rebranding it, it's pretty hard to argue we're reaching new students. You're really, your logo is reaching new students if that's all that you do. I would argue that with Purdue, where they've been successful, they've turned that into a mechanism to deepen their relationship within the state, offering free tuition to state employees and tuition discounts and expanding. So they're more of a national brand, but I think their success, what they've done differently, is much more of a becoming an Indiana serving institution.
Great, thanks. I want to pull us back a bit in time now. I want to go back to 2011, 2012, and the MOOC craze of those years. It all looks comically overwrought 12 years later, right? Everything was going to be disrupted, et cetera, et cetera. And it was all very strange because nobody at the time seemed to have given much thought to revenue. But now, with the benefit of a decade of distance from that craze, what do you think the long-term effect of MOOCs was?
All right, so I'll go to family therapy for this answer. So okay. Virginia Sautier is a family therapist who was very popular in the 70s and 80s, and she had written the Sautier model, change model. It was more family-based, but it talked about functioning units of family, in her case, being in a status quo. Then you have a foreign element that breaks the status quo. You go into chaos. And eventually you find a new idea that sticks, and then that starts to grow and you get to a new status quo level. And the key insight was the foreign element and the idea that sticks are almost always different things. I think MOOCs were that foreign element. MOOCs, along with 2U's initial business model, those were the two things that forced traditional higher education to get over themselves and say, we need to take online education seriously. If Stanford, Harvard, and MIT are saying it's important and pouring millions of dollars into this, who are we to disagree? So it broke that mentality of leave online to the continuing ed and to the for-profits. And so the lasting legacy is now you have most traditional colleges and universities who need to say, what's our online strategy? And the answer might be, we don't play in that space, or it's very limited on a few programs. But there's very few schools that don't think strategically about, or at least want to think strategically about online education now. And given that, I would also credit MOOCs indirectly with the COVID reaction. If schools hadn't been thinking about online education, if we hadn't been in the place we were, can you imagine COVID, if it happened back in 2010? How many schools just would have ceased functioning at that point? So I'd say those are the lasting legacy.
Yeah. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
This podcast is brought to you by Higher Education Strategy Associates, a sector-specific consultancy based in Toronto, Canada. Each year, on the day the Canadian federal budget is released, the HESA staff bring insights into how the budget will impact areas that matter most to higher education. Our reports cut through the funding announcement and discuss what the real changes are and what you need to know about them. The 2024 report is available now. Visit higheredstrategy.com to view this free publication.
And we're back. So, Phil, coming out of the MOOC craze, there were really two big companies in North America that survived the initial shakeout. So there was Coursera and there was edX, which was a product of MIT and Harvard. And until quite recently, I would say those two seemed to have relatively solid futures as independent providers of MOOCs or platforms for MOOCs. But then in 2021, Harvard and MIT sold edX to online program management firm 2U, who you've already mentioned. And what struck me at the time was they said it was because they couldn't compete on UX, on user experience. And I was blown away by this. If Harvard and MIT, with the billions of dollars they have at their disposal, couldn't compete on user experience, who could of institutions? Because I know you've got lots of individual institutions who are trying to create their own internal OPMs or their own internal platforms, the Kitty Hawk project at UNC, for instance. Was this the high point for OPMs when they could say, actually, we can beat Harvard and MIT at this game?
I would financially, I would say it would be a little bit earlier than that in the 2015-16 era. And it was when things were really coming into their own, but you didn't have an oversupply of every program trying to do, or too many online programs. I would view the edX acquisition as a low point for the OPM market. And the reason that drove it, I don't believe, was a user design UX. I think UX described why edX wasn't as good as Coursera. But I think that the reason they got they always had a throw spaghetti against the wall strategy. They never had a strategy. They tried everything. They had tens of millions of registered learners, but no real strategy. Whereas Coursera was a lot more deliberate. So the numbers might show them similar, but I think that they were different. The reason 2U bought them was all about the cost of acquisition. It was about finding a way to be able to not pay as much money to Google, Facebook, Instagram, what all the young kids use these days. And so it became an email list. That's oversimplifying it. But given that's why 2U bought them, they overpaid for it. That was a huge problem. I don't think it was based around the UX. I think the UX issue was one of the reasons they couldn't compete with Coursera. But from the OPM perspective, you had the second player, MOOC, even though it had tens of millions of learners, that didn't really have a strategy, and Harvard and MIT didn't know where to take it next. Then you had 2U who had another need, and it was a marriage they made that the dowry was too high.
So very soon after the sale of edX to 2U, much of the OPM market collapsed, right? So 2U's value is down, I think, about 95%, and you've been talking about them being in an endgame position. KeePath is down 90% plus. Coursera at one point was down 75%. What was it about 2022 exactly that made this whole market collapse? Was it just that interest rate spikes, and interest rate spikes meant that companies whose business models depended on near zero financing costs were suddenly in trouble? Or was it something else?
I think even before 2022, you had an oversupply. There were so many online programs competing with each other. And then you add to that the cost of digital marketing, the cost for AdWords and for the digital marketing going to the big tech firms, which going higher and higher, partially because of many programs bidding on the same words, but also for other reasons. So that was already happening, making it more difficult for individual programs to scale. In aggregate, you see the numbers going up, but I think individual programs already had stress. That's, again, why 2U bought edX. But the proximate cause of what the financial crisis is, as you said, it's the cost of money. Is when you are borrowing money, almost assuming that it's essentially zero interest rate, and then all of a sudden the entire environment changes in two regards. The cost of loans, because you have to renegotiate or re-up your loan if you can't pay it off. But there also has been a huge change in the investment environment. Equity for companies. Investors are no longer enamored with ed tech and online education and OPM companies. And so that's why their stock value's gone down. But that also means they can't use equity as additional money to fund this. So it's almost a perfect storm of multiple variables coming to a head in 2022. The biggest individual one to trace it to is the interest rates, however.
You published some data recently about the U.S. online market that I found absolutely astonishing. You had posted, and this was based on some data from iPeds, fully 25% of post-secondary enrollments in the U.S. are now fully online, and another 25% or so are at least partially online. I had no idea the market was that big. What do we know about these two groups of students? How similar are they to each other, and how different are they from other students? So I'm asking partially about demographics, but also about which subjects are they clustering in, if any?
It's interesting if you trace this growth back to 2011 or 12, when we really started getting good data to separate this out, the growth rate has pretty much tracked the same for fully online and students taking some online, some face-to-face. And both of those have been growing. And at the same time, what's going down is students who take no online. fully online students very much are centered more into working adult and people in situations where they can't go to campus. They have a family, they're working, they only have time at night to take classes. Sometimes it's convenient, but you have a lot more of that. Students taking one online course is much more, hey, I have a face-to-face program, but I want to graduate and I can't, I have two overlapping face-to-face courses. I need to take both. I'm going to take an online. Or increasingly students just saying, I like having the flexibility of online courses, even if I'm sitting in my dorm room for half the time. So I do think that the populations are naturally different in a broad description that way. But I also think that there's much more of a strategic move for institutions to view this as no longer as bimodal, online and face-to-face, but the need to say there's much more of a mixture, a spectrum across the board, and students should have the flexibility to sort of migrate between partially online, fully online, no online. I think you have that. Now, as far as what, where you have the clustering, you know, a lot of the highest usage of online is in business, online MBAs. Master's degree is probably the simple answer for fully online. But subject-wise, business, nursing, some health fields is where they tend to cluster. Whereas at least one online is much more broad-based, undergraduate, graduate, and across disciplines.
Do you see any other countries where online education is taking this kind of share of the student numbers? I mean, obviously, you've got countries, Korea, India, Bangladesh, where you have very large open universities, and some of that is online. Some of it's still on paper in South Asia. But are we seeing widespread adoption of online learning happening anywhere else at the speed it is in the United States? And if so, how are they making it work? Are they doing it through OPMs and that kind of thing?
You do see followers in the English-speaking world in particular. So you're seeing a rising online usage in the UK, Canada, and that's somewhat following the US model. You're right that the biggest online are the open universities and the national universities. Spain is another country that's got a very large presence there. Australia is a little bit different. Australia is a country where the population's very much on the periphery of the country and large distances. And for a long time, they've done stuff with online education ahead of the U.S. and in different ways. I found that they've actually collaborated and used online to collaborate institution to institution in a richer way before the U.S. does. So to answer your question, there's no other country that's in the same structural mode with the same growth rate as the U.S. That I'm aware of.
So I can't let this interview end without asking about COVID. The pandemic normalized online learning in much of the world. But at the same time, the snapback to in-person has been pretty substantial. Now that we're a couple of years clear of the worst of the pandemic, I guess we've got a little bit of perspective. How big an impact did the pandemic have on the online industry? And to what extent was it a decisive no going back event? And to what extent was it a flash in the pan?
First of all, if you look at the numbers, I think that obviously online went way up in 2020 and 21. And then there was a, as you called it, a snapback. But the snapback didn't go back to the previous trajectory. So if you just trace online growth and what it would have been, it was linear growth. It snapped back still to a level that's higher than that. And we're going back up again. So there's a step function it's provided, taking it up to a new, maybe a new quantum level, but then continuing similar growth. I think from more of a descriptive standpoint, part of what it did is so much of the discussion, including with faculty about online education, was it's bad, it's inferior, is it good? And there was this pointing fingers at each side. Mm-hmm. Part of the benefit of COVID, I'm not saying I'm pro-COVID, let's do it again. But it got almost everybody actually had experience in online education. So instead of talking about something they'd never done, you actually have better conversations now. You have all of the get back to the classroom, which became political. You have the Zoom University, which is a legitimate criticism. But I actually think that the dialogue, the learning that's happening within universities is richer now because most faculty and students and even administrators say, I've actually participated in this. I know what I'm doing. So I think part of the future growth is we're actually in a healthier level because of COVID, and you have a little bit of a quantum jump as well. So both of those, I think, have done it.
Last question. What's the future? If we come back and have this conversation in 10 years, what do you think the state of online learning will be? Will uptake among students be much higher? Will OPM still be around in some form? Will anyone remember what MOOC stood for?
First of all, I think it'll be much more blended. That whole point about it not being bimodal, I think it'll just be, you're not going to get to 100% of students being online or all courses being online. It's going to be much more of a multimodality options for students. And I think that it'll, so online will be pervasive, but it won't be up at 100% adoption. And there will be much better student mobility. This semester I need to do mostly online, but next semester I don't. Now, ironically, you probably won't be talking as much about semesters as well, largely due to online. I think you're going to have a lot more of the frequent starts and stops and a little bit more of the personalization on scheduling that's happening with students. But now, will people know about MOOCs? That'd be interesting. So if you look back, I think that there's so much political dialogue and higher education has such a long-term memory. I think the answer is yes. Now, it might be distorted and people misremember what things are, but higher education still operates emotionally, remembering what happened 15 years ago in the LMS space. They're still talking about Blackboard and where they bought WebCT. In the online space, there's still so much of a focus with for-profits. So yes, I do think people will know what MOOCs and OPMs are, no matter what the current form is when we get to that. But I'd say the biggest description of what the future looks like is much more blended, multimodal student mobility. That's a little bit aspirational, what I want to see as well as what I think is going to happen. But I think that's the direction we're heading.
Phil Hill, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
And it just remains for me to thank our excellent producers, Tiffany McLennan and Sam Pufek, and you, the listener, for tuning in. If you have any questions or comments about this episode or suggestions for future ones, please don't hesitate to get in touch with us at podcast@higheredstrategy.com. We'll be off next week, but in 2 weeks' time, join us again when we will be with Michigan State University's Brendan Cantwell, and we'll be talking about the culture wars in American higher education and, paradoxically, why funding is actually looking very good. Bye for now.
The World of Higher Education podcast is a Higher Education Strategy Associates production, produced by Tiffany McLennan and Samantha Pufek. Hosted by Alex Usher. Music by T. Bless and the Professionals. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.